At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Hi, guys. Thank you so much for joining me for part two of them.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who pieced together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Fernandez Brothers case. Woo! It's a long one. It's a deep dive. It's highly detailed. So I really appreciate you coming back. Let's kick off with today's true crime case, the Menendez brothers. So with all of this in mind, Abramson and Lansing, they follow Moen's advice because what Moen's is trying to get across is if you're going to talk about potential abuse, if you're going to talk about childhood, you need to make these young men seem, shall we say, more youthful so that the jury can connect with that.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who pieced together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
So they dressed them in boyish sweaters, khaki trousers, and you'll see that in some of the footage. And the premise of this is to kind of portray Eric and Lyle as younger than they were, because obviously we afford people who are younger the idea that they'll be less manipulative, less culpable because of their age. Now, this case became infamous, and the reason for that is Court TV broadcast the trial in 1990.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who pieced together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Three. So people were absolutely transfixed by what was playing out. They could not believe it. Bear in mind, like I said, the bias anyway is that these young men who had everything killed the parents and then just went on a spending spree. And to all intents and purposes, there hasn't been a lot in the press suggesting that there was reasoning behind their actions aside from incredible selfishness. So on the 20th of July, 1993, the trial begins with Mladenovic. She lays out her case against Lyle. And of course, she...
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice, and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Happens with a kicker. She basically talks about the absolute brutality of the murders, and she's 100% right. So she lays her foundation for her theory. She says these boys, these brothers, killed their parents after lying in wait. They were ready, they were armed, they were prepared. They thought about this. She also drew their attention to the spending spree. Bear in mind, there's Rolex watches, Lyle's Porsche, the fancy apartments.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Travel all over the world, Lyle's restaurant, Eric's personal tennis coach. So it wasn't really a hard sell to the jury that these guys have been, shall we say, a little bit frivolous with the parents' money. Now, Lansing began her opening statement by telling the jurors that Lyle and Eric killed their parents. That was no doubt. They had done that. She said, "We are not disputing when it happened. The only thing that you are going to have to focus on in this trial is why it happened. What we will prove to you is that the murders were committed out of fear. Fear of two parents who were so brutal, so manipulative, so sexually perverse that they drove their own sons to the most desperate act of defilement." So she detailed the lifestyle the brothers enjoyed growing up, because she was saying, look, if you're going to say money is the motive, well, why? They had everything. They weren't struggling. These young people could have what they wanted. That's not enough for them to think, well, I need to kill my parents so that I can get my hands on the cash. They had the cash. So for her, that wasn't a motive enough. So they built up the heart of their defense that the brothers killed the parents because they feared for their lives. And the reason they feared for their lives was because of the father's abuse over the years. And the abuse was sexual, it was physical, it was mental. She stated that the catalyst for why the murders took place was the fear that these secrets that laid at the foundations of the family was going to be revealed, would surface. She also stated that neither of the brothers had talked about the abuse until after they'd been arrested and incarcerated for months because they were absolutely ashamed. And the brothers had actually told a family member who in turn had informed their defense attorneys. So they hadn't actually had that conversation with the attorneys. They'd spoken to a family member who'd basically done it for them. Now, understandably, the prosecution were like, that's a little bit curious, that timing, a little bit curious. That all of a sudden, when we're dealing with the execution of their parents and they're spending all of their money, that suddenly they decide they've been abused. And that was the way that they were going to play into this situation during court, because that's the game. The game is he said, she said. I say that I was abused. We say you're making up the abuse to diminish responsibility in the killing of your parents. Now, Koriyama, what can we say about Koriyama? As I said earlier on, a little bit of contempt towards the brothers. So he's a really seasoned prosecutor, held the brothers in great contempt from the get-go, even more contempt than Pam Bosnick, which genuinely was very contemptuous in nature. They said they wanted to execute the parents and not get caught. So the brothers tried to create a web of deception, including the false alibis, lying to the police, a stolen ID, all about purchasing those shotguns. So they had really thought about how to get away with murder. Now, Abramson, they said, listen, Eric was groomed. And he was groomed for his father's sexual gratification. And when it came down to Kitty, they said her children were afraid of her. That's why she's dead. They couldn't turn to their mother for help and solace because all they found was a disturbed woman who dished out more abuse, sexual, physical, and psychological. Now, when it came down to the witnesses, 26 were called by the prosecution. The 911 call was how they began the case. They were playing Lyle's 911 call to the Beverly Hills Police Department for the jury because, come on, that's going to look really bad. We know there is no doubting in this case that those brothers executed their parents. There's no doubt. So therefore, you have to think about how it's going to come across to a jury when you hear the acting involved in the 911 call. They know it's staged. That's going to look really bad. Now, Officer Michael Butkus, he actually testified that he witnessed Lyle and Eric running around yelling after the murders, but also noticed an absence of tears. So that felt quite disconcerting. But again, bear in mind at the very beginning of this, guys, the police were really sympathetic. And it's amazing how when people start hearing other pieces of information, they change their memory. A memory is only ever a memory of a memory of a memory. That's why they change over time. That's why people embellish things. And that's why you can never absolutely take things as verbatim when the passage of time has occurred. So like I said, at the time, the police thought that these were innocent victims. But now in court, well, there was an absence of tears. Now, the next witness was actually a captain of that boat that took the Menendez family shark fishing on the 19th of August, 1989. Now, they described the Menendez family as odd. So the brothers apparently spent almost the entire 7-hour trip just huddled together at the front of the boat. And Abramson stated at this point that this is because they were afraid the boat trip was actually set up to kill them. And it is kind of weird that they were kind of curled up together, and it isn't demonstrating a close, intimate family at all. And it does speak of some tensions that are going on beneath the surface. And certainly for that individual who is taking them out shark fishing, to notice that is notable. Now, Les Zola testified that the brothers returned to the crime scene at 5:30 a.m. This is obviously after the parents had been killed. That was on the 21st of August, 1989. And the reason they did that was to ask for their tennis rackets, which is a bit weird. Now, they weren't allowed inside the house because the coroner was actually examining Jose and Kitty's bodies at that moment in time. So that does not look good for the jury, does it? I mean, it seems quite calculating to be thinking about tennis when your parents have been horribly murdered. Now, during cross-examination, one of the things that Abramson asked Zola is if he'd seen any animal droppings in the house. And he said, well, no, don't remember that. Now, the reason that Abramson, as a defence lawyer, was doing that was to lay the groundwork for the fact that they were trying to say, look, Kitty was a poor mother. She's a bad housekeeper. That's why you might find animal droppings in the house. So it's just kind of getting the jury to think, oh, this perfect family the prosecution are trying to paint maybe isn't quite as perfect as it's being portrayed. Now, Sergeant Edmonds, he was the person who conducted the police interview with Eric the morning after the murders. And he said he became suspicious of the brothers after Eric told him that when he entered the TV room on the night of the murder, he'd seen and smelt that smoke. He said, I felt that if he smelled smoke, it would have been pretty rapid after the shots were fired. He also said that several of the windows in the room had been shot out and that that would have caused the smoke to dissipate quickly. Again, though, in 7 months, the police hadn't turned up anything until the confessions that were taped. So is it that he really believed that at the time, or is it just something that he's building a picture around in this moment in court? They got a weapons expert in because they need to look at how these things played out. And that weapons expert demonstrated the operation of a 12-gauge Mossberg shotgun. And the reason for this is the prosecution, they absolutely want to show that the murders are utterly premeditated. And to fire a Mossberg shotgun, you're meant to have to pull the trigger and go through this two-stage pumping process before you refire the weapon. Now, Abramson objected to the demonstration because clearly that can be quite compelling if it makes it look like you really have to make an effort to go ahead and shoot these, but it was in fact overruled. Now, Craig Signorelli, remember the guy who was a friend of the Menendez brothers who tried to get them on tape admitting to the killings? He testified about his visit to the Beverly Hills mansion 12 days after the murders. This is where Eric described to him how it happened. So it's the first time the jurors hear Eric's version of offence and how that actually differed from the defence's argument. So this friend said that Eric never told him about any physical, any psychological or sexual abuse. And Judge Weisberg ruled that Eric and Craig's screenplay, Friends, couldn't actually be used as evidence as it was written too long before the murders. So it's a mixed bag where he's concerned. He's basically saying, well, no, he didn't tell me he'd ever been abused, neither of them did, but equally, this screenplay that I'm saying is actually evidence that they were planning the killing. It actually doesn't fit in time frame wise. But it's also worth noting at this moment in time that why are people expecting anyone to talk about their sexual abuse? One of the biggest things about being sexually abused is being in a prison of silence. It happens every single day of the week. You will hang around with people in your life who have been horrendously molested, and they will never whisper a moment of their description of their childhood or their adolescence when this played out, because they feel absolutely guilty. Because that's what abusers do. They make you feel responsible for what's happened. They make you feel dirty and ashamed and disgusted. They make you feel like you wanted it even though you didn't want it. They do all those things. It's the playbook of the abuser. This idea that just because somebody hasn't told you that somebody has sexually violated you means that you're lying, that's just so ridiculous. And it really makes me struggle when I see the same kind of conversations happening even today as they were happening back then. This idea that if you haven't admitted that you were sexually abused to everybody, then clearly you weren't sexually abused. If that was the case, the moment that anybody was sexually abused ever in the history of sexual abuse, somebody would go and tell somebody and it would get stopped. It doesn't happen. It goes on sometimes for decades. I've worked on cases where literally the great grandparent is the parent of all the other generations of children because they've been molesting families for decades. This happens, and the wall of silence is enormous. So again, it's not enough for me to hear people saying, well, they didn't tell me. You know, it's really hard to talk about abuse. And back in the day, I would imagine as a young man, it's even more challenging because people didn't believe that young men actually could be abused. And to put this into context, it was considered that men could not actually be raped for a very, very long time. I mean, I'm talking about right up until modern times, because the belief was that could only happen to a woman. It's ludicrous. In fact, it was put in the same level as a bullying situation when you think about it criminally compared to what it would be for a woman. So it was really challenging. Now, Donovan Goodrow, that's another friend, he said that his wallet with his ID that had been left behind in Lyle's dorm room at Princeton, he had to leave because he'd been accused of stealing. So he said he confessed to Lyle during this situation that he'd been molested when he was a boy. Lyle allegedly didn't respond with any similar stories, never mentioned being sexually abused during the entire time they were roommates. Again, that means nothing. That means nothing. This idea that, oh, well, I tell you that something terrible happened to me and you tell me the same. Why? People who are traumatized don't follow the same patterns. That's what trauma does. Some people can invest trust in other human beings and some people can't. When you have parents who are funding your lifestyle, the idea of confessing that something terrible is happening to you can be too terrible to even imagine. And you think, what will happen consequence-wise if I do? And also, if you genuinely thought that somebody would kill you, well, why would you tell somebody about it? Now, Donovan's credibility was actually challenged pretty effectively by the defense, because the defense brought up an interview that he'd given to Robert Rand, who was a freelance writer. That was in March 1992. Now, in that interview, Donovan actually mentioned that he heard that Jose had abused Lyle. Now, Rand then gave a copy of that taped interview to a Los Angeles TV reporter, and they played it on that night's evening news. Now, Bosanich was really angry that Rand had basically, as far as they were concerned, injected himself into the trial's proceedings. They said that Donovan had been fed information about Jose and that Lyle was repeating a story he had heard. But you can understand, can't you? The prosecution would be very annoyed if this guy's on the stand going, oh no, nothing was ever said about abuse. And then it turns out there's literally a taped interview talking about that abuse. Now, Glenn Stevens, this is another friend, followed immediately after Donovan's testimony ended. He said, yeah, I did hear stories of abuse from Robert Rand, and then I repeated those stories to Donovan. So essentially, they're bringing them in and saying, well, this is why that information has been passed in this way. Now, Glenn's credibility also gets called into question. So Lansing had managed to find a resume of his, and it exposed, shall we say, a number of embellishments on it. So Glenn, for example, wrote that he kept the accounting records for Mr. Buffalo's, which he didn't, claimed it had sales of $1 million per year, which it didn't. And then Glenn ends up admitting that Lyle gave him one of his Rolex watches, which he then sold and pocketed the money from. So again, for the jury, that's causing his testimony into question. Now, Dr. Erwin Golden, he's the Los Angeles County Assistant Coroner. So he's brought in to testify about basically the wounds that the couple suffered. So he talked about the 10 wounds inflicted on Kitty and the 6 on Jose, said that all of the wounds occurred in quick succession, so execution style, essentially. But I would say the prosecution's star witness is Dr. Azeel. So to Bosnick and Kuriyama, Azeel is the golden goose, because this man provides essentially the only really detailed recreation of the murders, and he creates them in the brother's own words. So on the 4th of August 1993, Dr. Azeel began the first of 6 days of testimony. So you can imagine being on the stand for 6 days. Now, he said the brothers wanted to kill Jose because he was dominating their lives. He made them feel inferior. And he also said the reason they killed Kitty was because they didn't want to leave her behind as a witness. He said that Eric had told him the plan was to kill Jose and Kitty because he'd been watching a BBC television show, and he felt that, similarly to what had played out there, they were dominated, they were controlled. It was impossible to please his father, and the way out was to kill both of them, both the father and mother. They didn't believe that Jose could be separated from Kitty, that she would never survive without him emotionally. So it was better to kill him because he deserved it, and to kill her because she couldn't cope. Now, before Azeel even takes the witness stand, Abramson promises to, quote, attack his credibility in every way known to man and God. They actually believe that Azeel created the tapes for his own purpose, and that Lyle and Eric basically told Azeel what he wanted to hear. So on the 23rd of July 1993, the California State Board of Psychology actually filed a complaint that sought to revoke Azeel's license because he'd allegedly engaged in a sexual, social, or business relationship with 2 patients, which is like so against the ethics. Now, the defense brought up Azeel's affair with Judalyn Smith, who basically, after the pair had broken up, sued Azeel, actually alleged that he'd assaulted her, raped her, kidnapped her, medicated her, and he actually settled outside of court, so paid her off. The defense also used the State Board of Psychology complaint that Azeel improperly prescribed drugs for Smith and had an improper dual relationship with another patient, exchanging his services for construction work done at his house. So he's really not operating in an appropriate manner. Now, he wasn't the only one, shall we say, that had improper relationships outside of marriage, because Jose had a mistress as well. So his former mistress, a woman called Louise, she was basically following the trial on court TV, and she called Pam Bosnick, who of course is the person prosecuting, to say that the man she knew was nothing like the person being destroyed by the defense. She also told Bosnick that Kitty had actually confronted her about the affair. But rather than, as she put it, behaving like a raving lunatic, Louise said Kitty was, quote, as pleasant as she could be under the circumstances and just wanted to make sure the affair was over. Now, she wasn't actually called as a witness because the prosecution didn't want to subject her to an enormous amount of media scrutiny. But I'm going to be honest with you guys, that doesn't necessitate that we can say, oh, well, okay then, Jose was a great guy. The mistress said that. And also, I really question Kitty in this moment. It's a really weird set of circumstances. Look, I don't think that anybody should be in blind rage when you find out that your husband is having an affair with somebody, but you know what? I'm going to be pissed. I'm going to be annoyed. And I'm not just going to check whether the relationship's over. I mean, probably I'm just going to divorce you with respect. That's certainly what I did in my first marriage. You know, you have an affair, I ain't going to be staying. But even if I wanted to stay, I think that I would never want to see you because you had been intimate with my husband. Or if I did see you, I'm going to have some choice words and it won't be, are you sure it's over? Thank you very much. I think that speaks of something quite strange about Kitty and indeed Jose. That's just my personal opinion. Everybody's opinion is welcome here. And the reason I'm saying that I'm not just going to take Louise, his mistress's words at face value is because the prosecution couldn't find one single character witness for Jose. Not one. Aside from that mistress, everyone Bosanek got in contact with described Jose as, quote, a tyrant. Now, I've been around the block quite a lot. I'm sure many of you have. Life hits us in the face very often. We meet lots of people often. And you know what? Some people like us, some people don't like us. But I can guarantee that if I was in court, there'd be a lot of people coming forward with character witnesses for me. And I would do exactly the same for a lot of people. Like even people that I've just had small interactions with because they're just a nice person and I would believe in their character. Didn't find one. That is very unusual. That's what we'd expect to see if you were a real long-time criminal who'd just done the most diabolical of things. But he's known as a tyrant. And I think that therefore has to give us a level of leverage in believing some of the accusations the boys had made, some of the accusations these young men had levied at Jose, that he was indeed not a very nice person to be around at all. Now, the defense, when it came down to who they were going to call, they wanted 90 witnesses. And the judge was like, I think that's maybe too many. And I can understand why, because we don't want trials to play out for 100 years. But, you know, if there's 90 witnesses, arguably the reason they want to call them is to compound why they believe that their clients should not be tried in the way that they're being tried and found guilty. But the truth is that Judge Weisberg ended up forcing them to trim the list to 50, which is still a lot. Now, the defense case lasted 3 months. And they had this really difficult task of essentially trying to prove that the brothers were in imminent danger before they killed the parents, because that's the defense that's required if they're going to be acquitted or convicted of manslaughter instead of murder. So under California law, that's what they need to prove. Now, in order to actually obtain either of those verdicts, the defense needed to prove two things: that Lyle and Eric had indeed been in fear of their lives, and that the conduct of their parents would have produced that same state of mind in a reasonable person. So you or I, if we had been in that situation, we could have found ourselves acting in exactly the same way. And they have got, shall we say, a hill to climb there, just because we know that there are those recordings that these men have admitted to killing their parents and also the dubious behavior after the killings. Now, before Lyle's testimony, Jose had only been accused essentially of, what can we say, browbeating his sons, making them work really hard to get excellent grades and to be brilliant in tennis, you know, to really excel. But when Lyle takes the stand, well, he paints a profoundly different and far more dark picture. He said that his father had begun showing both himself and his brother pornographic videos and telling him about homosexual bonding rituals between soldiers in ancient Greece when he was 6 and Eric was 3. Now, again, there are going to be people screaming at this screen that you're watching with me on it going, Emma, this is bullshit. I know a lot of people feel that way. I'm just going to bring in this. I think it's a really unusual thing to say because it feels very specific. I mean, you can talk about pornography every which way, but the particular pornography they're describing seems quite left field. And if you're going to make something up, you're probably going to go for something that's quite obvious. So sure, homosexual pornography, that makes sense. You know, if you're trying to invent that these things happened, but homosexual bonding rituals between soldiers in ancient Greece, that really stands out to me. Also, Jose took naked pictures of Lyle and Eric when they were young, and those pictures were showed to the jury. That is so wrong. I appreciate that there have been times where we have taken photographs of our babies and children when they're in the baths, etc., and we keep them to ourselves because we have absolutely no connection with anything inappropriate. But that's not what was being shown to the jury. It just feels really odd the way that he's taking these photographs. Now, Lyle, he recalled that his father would massage him in the bedroom after sports practices when he's a child. And that, again, is not something that is out of the ordinary. Of course, when our children have taken part in sports, they can get stiff muscles. And it's really lovely to give them a massage. But it goes from that, according, of course, to Lyle, that this ends up becoming forced oral sex. He said he first did this with a toothbrush in what Jose called object sessions. Again, that's really unusual. Again, I'm not saying this happened or didn't happen. I'm just giving you my experience, having worked in sexual trauma for a very long time, and why I find it strange. Because if you are inventing a story to talk about an individual who has been depraved around you on a sexual level, it's quite hard to introduce things like the words object sessions. Because there are many simple ways to deceive people about your sexual molestation, and you will tend to stick to more typical routes, simply because for the individual hearing it, you don't really need to hear more than being digitally penetrated or being anally penetrated or having forced oral sex. When you start bringing in this very detailed reality of your experience, it just stands out to me. And he said that that then evolved into Jose anally raping him. He said that because of that behavior from his father to himself, he ended up taking his own brother out to the woods along with a toothbrush, and he actually ended up touching Eric in the same way his father was touching him. That is actually quite a typical response. We see that throughout families where a child or children are being molested, because obviously a primary caregiver is doing this to you, so you don't think there's anything wrong with it. And sometimes it can feel quite nice. And that's another really big problem where abuse is concerned. And it's one of the big struggles that people who've had horrendous molestation incur, because they think, well, I enjoyed some of those feelings, therefore I must be culpable. No, you didn't. Psychologically, you didn't enjoy it. Physically, you enjoyed it. It's also why people become very sexually problematic as they get older. You know, they don't want to have sex with people. They feel very dysfunctional around sexual behavior. They feel repulsed when people come near them, even if it feels nice, because they've got this mismatch between physical touch and the sensory experience of pleasure versus the psychological torture they endured. And it's so bloody confusing. So this is why we see children play out with other children. They're just doing what they have been taught to do. And because it doesn't feel too horrible at that point, because they haven't gone through the psychological distress of realizing what's actually occurring, they don't think there's anything wrong with it. Now, he said that abuse stopped when he was 8. But at this point, his father threatened to kill him if he ever revealed the truth. And this would again be completely typical. This is what abusers do. They wall you in to fear. He actually said he went to his mum for help, and he said, I told my mum to tell dad to leave me alone, that he keeps touching me. She told me to stop it, that I was exaggerating, and that my dad had to punish me when I did things wrong. Again, this is hearsay, but if she did do that, that is an abandoning on every level as a nurturing mother. It is the absolute opposite of what any child requires. It is not, however, unusual. I have spent many years working with young people who have gone through exactly this, the abandoning of that role by a parent because it's too difficult to actually acknowledge what's going on and to change the circumstances to make that child safe. Instead, make the child the problem, not the abuse. Now, Lyle said that Kitty, his mother, also sexually abused him when he was 11 and 12. Said that when he was young, when he was a young boy, she would actually show him pictures of her in a bathing suit or lingerie, which is so weird. Also, he said when he was 11, she would literally go topless in front of him. She would wear an open robe or she'd be naked. Now, I will come down and say that is not tantamount to sexual abuse. I appreciate that lots of parents will walk around without any concern with their children not wearing clothes. Everybody has a different mindset around that stuff. And when you're bringing up children to be body positive, a lot of people are quite happy just being themselves naked in front of their kids. There is no sexual overtones. There are no issues. And actually, some people believe that that's giving their children an understanding that bodies are normal and not perfect, you know? They're not looking at women and thinking, oh, they're all Victoria's Secrets models. They're more, okay, it's okay that mum's got some roles and that dad's got some roles. This is normal. So people do walk around naked at times in front of their kids. People do get changed in front of their kids. And certainly in Europe, I've been in Germany as a teenager, been taken into a sauna by adults, and everybody was naked. I was the only kid in a red swimming costume. And yes, it seared into my mind because in the UK, we don't tend to do that. So it's not always sexual. So that behaviour, I suppose we could compartmentalise to some degree. But she would ask him how she looked. Now that is overstepping the mark because this is a child. The child isn't going to look at you in any other way than you are mummy. You are perfect, but you are nothing to do with being a sexual being. He also said that he would touch Kitty everywhere, quote, even when his father was actually sharing the same bed with them. So clearly the boundaries were completely blurred and inappropriate behaviour was happening all the time. And until he was 13, he said that Kitty, his mother, would wash his body, quote, everywhere. And he said, look, I took it to be love. He knew that she was enjoying it, but he wasn't. Now, when those activities stopped, when he stopped touching her because he just didn't like it, she got really angry. He said that throughout his adolescence, she literally harassed him with increasingly bizarre sexual conduct. And when he started to dare to date, Kitty actually called his girlfriends gold diggers, bimbos. In 1989, apparently he dated a model. His mother called her a slut. She said that this model apparently had HIV and wouldn't allow Lyle to eat using family dishes or eat in the dining room because of this relationship. He said, I ate off paper plates in the den. Now, again, this could just be fabrication. Of course it could. But it's really weird to make this kind of detail up. It would be far simpler to come up with some kind of story that doesn't seem so bizarre. You could easily say, my mum was an utter bitch. She wouldn't let me have girlfriends. When I had girlfriends, she called them whores. Now, I get that. Perfect. We've got a reason to be angry. We've got a reason that demonstrates this woman was aggressive towards him, was aggressive towards him, was hostile towards him, prevented him having freedom. That's all you need. And that's all a jury needs to hear. To actually come up with this, she said that my girlfriend had HIV. I wasn't allowed in the dining room. I had to eat off paper plates. That's not what a liar on the whole will come out with because it seems so bizarre. Again, I'm not saying he's telling the truth. I'm just saying it from it. Is this a typical way to spin a yarn? Some of you will say yes. He's being highly manipulative. He's figured that out. So he's creating information that seems so bizarre you have to believe it. Now, Lansing asked Lyle, why didn't you run away from home? And Lyle said, well, we couldn't run away from home. My dad was so powerful. He'd have found me. He'd have found both of us. He'd have punished us. He'd have killed us. He said, Eric and him thought the police would never believe that they were being abused. And I got to say, that would not have been uncommon. I cannot express how often I have dealt with cases where it has been so obvious this person has definitely been horrifically abused and it has still not been tried. So it is not easy to get people to take you seriously. And also, when people are abused, there is often this majority of cases where people retract for a period of time. So children will say, this has happened. People get involved like social care workers, teachers, and then all of a sudden it's too scary. And they're like, no, it didn't really happen. And then they're called liars. So there is a whole reasoning why people feel that they aren't going to be believed and indeed are not believed at the time. And these are young men. And let me tell you, people were not believing young men when they were being abused. It was a time that was prolific for this kind of negligence where young men and women were concerned. Now, when they testified about the physical abuse, one of the things that was brought up was Lyle was having tennis lessons with his coach. Jose was shouting at him, he was ridiculing him, which is awful. To humiliate your child is the worst thing you can do. And I'm just going to say, you know, we all need a bit of tough love, particularly when you're in sports that are at a high level. You know, people don't take any prisoners. You know, do the do and figure it out. And if you're not in the game, leave because it's hard work. But humiliating somebody really isn't helpful. It doesn't really help somebody to develop confidence. And at this point, he said, look, at that point, I really did lose my temper with my dad for the first time. And I told him to shut up. And he said his father's face went red. His whole demeanor changed. He actually threw a ball at Lyle. And he said he let the ball hit him because he wanted his dad to know, yeah, okay, you've achieved it. You've punished me. And he wanted to avoid any further punishment. But that was not enough for Jose. Jose took him to the car, took him away from any witnesses, punched him in the face and said, if you talk back to me again, I will kill you. Which is harrowing, isn't it? If that happened, that's the absolute opposite of what a parent should ever do to a child. Now, in the lead up to the murders, Lyle said that he'd actually been so stressed that his hair had begun falling out. And this is at age 14. So any of you out there who are hairdressers, barbers, etc., you will know that one of the biggest precursors, particularly of male hair loss, is stress. It's something that a lot of people don't talk about because of my work with clients and my work over the years with people with incredible trauma. One of the things that I've researched is the impact of stress on male hair loss. And if you go through stressful periods, and of course, there's a genetic predisposition, losing your hair is something that's going to occur very often early on, which is very distressing. But 14 years of age, are you kidding me? That speaks of something very challenging occurring to this child. Now, in the late 1980s, Jose was ashamed of Lyle's hair loss. Again, why would you be ashamed? The only thing you'd be concerned of as a loving parent is that your child is struggling to a degree and that they are losing their hair. And it would be so atypical. When you look at their peers, you'd be thinking, what's going on? Do I need to get some medical intervention? Do I need to speak to some specialist? But not Jose. He just wants him to buy a toupee before he attends Princeton University. And Lyle was embarrassed. He didn't tell anyone about his toupee. He didn't tell Eric, apparently. And 5 days before the murders, there was this incident. Kitty essentially began arguing with Lyle. So this argument seemed to escalate and certainly seemed to have something to do with the hairpiece itself. And his mother was apparently out of control. She was flailing her arms around. She was screaming during the fight. And she just at one point grabs the hairpiece and just rips it off, which is horrific. Bear in mind, your father's ashamed of the fact you're losing your hair. You've not confided in your brother that you've lost your hair. And now your mother, the person who's meant to make you feel safer than anybody else, has just humiliated you. He said that he attached and wore the toupee usually with a solvent glue on the skin, which is obviously how it sticks down. And he said it was really painful, aside from the emotional pain. It was actually physically painful when his mother did that. And he said, my brother didn't even know I had a hairpiece. He said, I was just absolutely humiliated in front of my brother. Now, apparently that event is a thing that, shall we say, synchronized and connected the brothers even more together. They became even closer at that moment. And shortly afterwards, Eric confessed to Lyle that Jose had indeed been sexually molesting him. That same day, Lyle confronted his father about him and said, stop. Jose apparently said, what I do with my son is none of your business. I warn you, don't throw your life away. Now, Lyle persisted at this moment, said his father would be exposed if he didn't stop, that he'd talk about the abuse and tell others if it continued. And Jose said, we all make choices in life, son. Eric made his, you've made yours. Apparently, from that moment on, Lyle felt that his and Eric's lives were just in danger. He said he felt that he'd got no choice, that he was going to get killed by his father, that they'd get rid of them in some way because he thought that he was going to ruin him, that Jose thought that the boys were intending to tell people about the abuse. Apparently, Kitty became absolutely hysterical after the confrontation, and she told Eric that if Lyle had just kept his mouth shut, things might have worked out in this family. A little bit like Kitty in the affair. You know, she kept her mouth shut. Yes, she spoke to the adulteress, but at the end of the day, she didn't do anything about it. Just let's be quiet. Let's go back into our shell. Let's pretend everything's all right. Now, the brothers basically said at that moment in time, they thought, my God, she's on the same side as our dad. She's also in on this plot to kill us. Apparently, things are quite tense in the house for the next few days. When their parents went and withdrew to the den, when they closed the door, that was something that the couple apparently hadn't done before. So the brothers decided, according to them, that they thought they were going to be attacked at that point. So this is when they went upstairs, when they got their guns, and when they burst through the door firing. So that's how they present in court. Now, when Bosnick did the cross-examination, understandably, what they did over that four-day period of talking to Lyle was to just belittle his account of the killings, also to just challenge him to whether that abuse occurred full stop. So just undermining this theory that these individuals had indeed been abused at all. Now, when Eric Menendez took to the stand, he began his testimony on the 27th of September 1993, and he started to talk about the abuse and how it escalated. He said that during swimming lessons, his father used to hold his head under the water for 30 seconds at a time with this mindset of trying to train his lungs to expand. Now, I agree, that this would be something that if you were consensual to would actually help. This actually is something that I, as somebody who used to be a county swimmer, used to experience. You know, we used to hold our breath to try to get some lung expansion. But if you're not ready for it, if you're scared, if you're being held under, if somebody's actually physically doing it, it's terrifying. And he said that Kitty was actually there quite a lot when it happened, but she just didn't help. She didn't intervene. He actually testified to being abused, not only in the bathroom and the bedroom at his own house, but also outside of the house too. He said he was abused when he was in hotel rooms. He was abused when he was on a holiday. He said he was physically and sexually abused from the time he was six until 1989, when he finally snapped and killed his parents. He said that from the age of six, his dad would massage his genitals, and that at the time, reflecting on it, he enjoyed it. It was the only time he got to spend alone with his dad, and his dad came across as kind and caring when that was happening. But then age seven, Eric was made to start performing sex acts on his father. And then just after that, Jose began sodomizing Eric with wooden objects. Age 10, Jose would get Eric to begin anally penetrating him to teach him what to do before then going on and doing the same to him. And then Jose became even more sadistic and started to use needles and pins and would stick them in Eric's thigh. Occasionally, he also tied up Eric's penis with rope. He, as a child, said, "I didn't know how to deal with this. And one of the things I really struggled with was the fact that my father would force me to give him oral sex. So in the end, I would start sneaking honey and cinnamon into my father's food and coffee because somebody at school had said it made semen taste better." Again, this is something that stands out for me because it just seems so left field to bring it in. It's not necessarily something that a jury who will never have heard anything like this before are going to be able to conceive of, which is why if you're going to absolutely lie about these things, it would be better to just break it down to my father made me have oral sex with him and forced it on me. But actually to go through saying I put cinnamon and honey in my father's food and coffee because the taste of semen was so awful, that feels like a real lived experience. He also said that when Eric was older, the type of sex Jose would have with him was nice or not nice, depending on whether he won a tennis match. So clearly the sadism played out more when he had failed as far as Jose was concerned. And there is one thing that I think comes across very clearly about Jose as a human being. Firstly, because he couldn't even get a character witness. People said he was a tyrant. Also because he was witnessed being very aggressive when the boys were doing anything wrong, like losing a tennis match. And also just the domination that we hear personality-wise regarding this guy. So I think we can all agree that whoever Jose was, successful as a businessman he may have been, but he wasn't a very nice guy. It may not have been very easy growing up with an individual as a father, such as Jose. Also, he recalled a time when Jose was conducting a, quote, drill with Eric when he was 13, and he made Eric look in the mirror and asked him what he thought Jose would do to him if he ever told anybody about the sexual abuse. And Eric said, "You'd hurt me," to which Jose said, "No." Eric then said, "You'd kill me." Jose apparently nodded. He recalled another time when Jose walked into his room holding a large kitchen knife, threatening to kill Eric if he told anyone of the abuse, which is, again, very typical of abusers. And that makes sense abuse-wise. I mean, you get different types of abuse. You get the person who showers an individual with gifts, makes the child feel super special, makes them believe that they're the only person who truly loves them, makes them feel like they will always be present for them. It confuses the child as they grow up and it buys their loyalty, essentially. And that's just devastating because as they grow older, they don't feel they can speak out about what happened because of that relationship. And then you get the tyrants who threaten and make the person feel that they will go ahead and kill them. And you know, when the been getting away with raping them for a long period of time, well, hey, killing them is just one step further. So that's an effective way of operating as an abuser. Now, Diane van der Molen, that's Lyle and Eric's cousin, they testified that in 1976, this is when she's 17 and Lyle's eight, he tells her about the sexual abuse. Lyle told her that on this particular night that he was with her, he was scared to sleep in his own bed in case Jose came in to molest him. Now, Diane tells Kitty what Lyle said, but Kitty just didn't believe her and refused to talk about the subject again. But that's damning, as far as I'm concerned. That's damning. You have a member of family whose child has confided in you and you actually speak to the parent, it means that you felt the child was firstly believable and you wanted to change the outcomes for that child. The mother rejects that, but certainly that is in line with what the Menendez brothers are talking about regarding the molestation they experienced during childhood. Now, apparently during the lead up to the murders, this wasn't brought out in court, but nonetheless, this is what's been garnered from what's been said in different arenas. As Eric's time in high school is coming to an end, he starts thinking about college. And like a lot of us, he starts thinking about how college could be a way out. And for him, it's a way out of abuse. Now, his main plan was he was going to go to Stanford University. Now, still in California, but it's just far away enough so that he can move out of the family home, just have that freedom, get away from his father's clutches. But 7 days before the murders, Jose says to Eric, you're not allowed to go to Stanford, and he would have to attend UCLA and continue living at home. Again, what does that tell you about Jose's nature? That's incredibly domineering. How dare you? This is a young man growing up. He's about to go to achieve his dreams educationally and academically. And his father's saying, well, no, you're not going to do that. You're going to stay here at home and you're going to go to this university. That is control on steroids. Now, Eric later said, it's important to understand why this was so traumatic for me. I believed I was going to go to college to get away from what was happening with my father. That was the most important thing in my life. It drove everything I did. So when it was taken away from me, I remember walking around like a zombie. I didn't know what to think. And I just eventually went and broke down to Lyle. So he goes and tells his brother, I can't believe this one chance, this one opportunity to escape, it's been taken away from me. Now, Dr. Vickery, who is brought in to talk about the sessions that they'd had with Eric, he said that that was the end of the rope. And he was actually thinking about taking his own life because he just did not want to endure the rapes of his father anymore. And I guess he also felt like, I'm an adult now. I'm going to be able to go and live my life, get on with my career ideas and aspirations, my academic journey. And yet my father is saying, no, you'll do exactly what I tell you. Now, Anne Tyler was the psychologist who was the first expert to be called to testify. She said that the Menendez brothers suffered from a condition called learned helplessness. And learned helplessness basically is a condition that occurs as a result of intense, repeated abuse. Some of you who've studied psychology may have heard about learned helplessness because of an experiment that was done on dogs. And basically, dogs were given shocks and essentially they couldn't control the shocks that were happening. It didn't have any rhyme or reason. And in the end, they just lay down and let themselves get shocked. It's horrific that they were ever allowed to do tests like that. But essentially, the idea is that you think, what's the point? I don't have any power. I am totally helpless. She said, as an expert, she had no doubt whatsoever that Jose and Kitty Menendez had absolutely psychologically abused their sons in virtually, quote, every possible way. Tyler also noted the naivety of the brothers and said that that naivety was clear when they were giving their testimony, that there was just an emotional immaturity about them. There was a vulnerability, essentially, about them. Now, Anne Burgess, she was a professor of psychiatric mental health, nursing. Now, Anna Burgess, she was another expert. She was a professor of psychiatric mental health nursing at the University of Pennsylvania. She was also an expert in crime scene analysis. She was the person who examined the crime scene pictures. And she said, when I look at those pictures, I can see that the crime was disorganized. So the crime scene, as far as she was concerned, wasn't the product of a premeditated murder. She said the random nature of the wounds had actually led her to believe that there was an overkill element. So it showed a lack of planning and obviously more of an emotional connection and component. They also called Stuart Hart. He's an Indiana University professor, and he testified about his belief that Lyle had been severely psychologically mistreated. So these are all experts, and they're all coming in and telling a different story to what the prosecution are pushing. Now, John Conte, he interviewed Lyle in jail for 60 hours in 1993. That's a lot. So he believed, without a doubt, he was telling the truth about the abuse because of the effect it had on Lyle. He said he was ashamed. He said he was really reluctant to talk about the abuse because he just found it embarrassing. And this is how abuse victims often feel. Then they brought in Dr. Kerry English, medical director of the child abuse team at Martin Luther King Hospital in South Central Los Angeles. They testified, though, that they found no evidence, and this is really weird, guys, no evidence that Eric had been sodomized. Now, I have worked in a lot of abuse cases, okay? I've worked in a lot of rape cases. What do you mean there was no evidence of Eric being anally sodomized? I mean, that would suggest it had just happened. Yes, sometimes when people have been damaged as children, you can see evidence of injury, but very often that's not the case. The idea that you can examine someone and say, well, you haven't been anally penetrated because even though you're grown up now and the molestation hasn't necessarily occurred for a period of time and everything's therefore looking okay, I'm going to say it just never happened. That doesn't make sense as far as I'm concerned. But Dr. English had reviewed Eric's medical records from the time he was a child, and they actually drew attention to an injury from 1977. It read, hurt posterior pharynx, uvula, and soft palate healing well. Now, when asked if such an injury to the back of the throat could be caused by child abuse, he answered, yes, oral copulation. Of course, that's what happens when an adult is forcibly using a child's mouth, because clearly they are not built for such. So there is evidence. And like I said, it gets really frustrating when what happens in court is, well, where's the physical evidence? And I know that some people will be like, well, you need something, because at the end of the day, anybody could say anything. But historic abuse is often not going to give you that. And it does not mean that historic abuse did not occur. Now, Judalyn Smith, bear in mind, the ex of Dr. Azeel, she was called by the defense to actually discredit Azeel's testimony. Now, she actually testified for 2 days, and that revolved around two main themes. So basically that Azeel manipulated and bullied her into a relationship, and also that many of her earlier statements about Lyle and Eric were mistaken. Now, Bosanic was not happy about this. She wasn't happy that one of the star witnesses was getting discredited. She was really annoyed that Smith was recanting her earlier statements once she'd made to the police. And Bosanic actually believed that she was angry at the district attorney's office for not filing rape charges against Azeel. So her case had been referred to the DA's Sex Crimes Division, which had basically rejected the case because of a lack of evidence. So Bosanic is like, oh, the reason you want these two people who've murdered their parents in the most brutal of fashions to get away with it is just to piss off your ex. But like I said, Bosanic was very contemptuous of the Menendez brothers and never wanted them to have an option to walk free. So they cross-examined Smith about the different versions of the same story. And she said, listen, I was not responsible for my earlier answers. Azeel had drugged me, he'd brainwashed me. And Smith was actually the last of the 50 witnesses who was called by the defense. And that would be quite powerful with respect, although it is relatively easy if you're a good prosecutor to just throw some caution around that testimony in regards to the way that she felt about Azeel because he had done horrible things to her, apparently. Now, when it came down to the closing arguments, Lansing reminded jurors that the crime was carried out in a state of fear and panic that followed year after year after year of abuse by bullying parents. And they said to the jury, listen, think about the whole. Don't think about the event. Think about everything that happened, dating all the way back to Lyle's childhood sexual molestation. See the murder as a final chapter to a book that has been written over the years. They said that Lyle was operating basically like an unthinking robot on the night of the 20th of August, 1989, and that he shot his parents on instinct and not because he'd carefully thought out a plan. And they said, it may be hard for you to believe that these parents could have killed their children, but is it so hard to understand that these children believed their parents would kill them? So their argument basically is the circumstances didn't meet the legal standards for first degree murder. Now, bear in mind what I said about Bosanic. Well, she's a very sarcastic person. She's also quite bitter when it comes down to her closing statement. And don't get me wrong, I appreciate that the prosecution are invested in bringing people to justice, but it just feels deeply personal, almost like she looked at the Menendez brothers and thought, you had everything. And look who you've become, and you don't deserve any empathy, and I don't believe anything that you've said. She actually called Lyle and Eric spoiled, vicious brats. who got the best defense daddy's money could buy. She said, this is not a complicated case. These two people were watching TV and they got slaughtered by their sons. Bosnick stated that, quote, men, and this is where me and Bosnick need to sit down and have, I don't know, a lengthy conversation for 3 weeks. They said, men could not be raped because they lack the necessary equipment to be raped. Now, I don't know who's guilty, who's innocent, whether it's right to have sent them to prison for the rest of their natural life or otherwise. But what I do know is if I'd been in that court, I would have got done for contempt because something would have been thrown at this person's head. Honestly, I say that without any care in the world. If you suggest that it is impossible for a young man or a child who's male to be raped because they don't have a vagina, you need to be taken to task immediately. So this person is incredibly prejudiced. It's as simple as that. Also, they rightly so challenged the idea that the brothers didn't plan the murders because the brothers had obviously gone to San Diego to purchase the shotguns. Although, with respect, if they were feeling under threat, they may have wanted to do that anyway. And they also quoted from a transcript from one of Azeel's tapes. And this is when Lyle said there would be no way he would have carried out the shootings alone and had decided to let Eric sleep on the plan. And they stated, for all those children who were severely abused and who became useful members of society, this defense is an offense. That's powerful, of course. Do we believe that children who grow up should go and blow the brains out of their parents when they've abused them? No. And 99% of people would never even consider being violent towards a parent who's been abusive. But you know what? Sometimes certain people have mindsets that are not typical. And if you happen to have a mindset that's not typical, and if you believe there's no escape, well, maybe you really will just think that using a gun to blow your parents' brains out is a better idea than just walking out of the house. It doesn't make sense, but that's because abuse makes people feel that the world is nonsensical. And also, if we think about cases where women have been battered beyond belief consistently through their lives, coercively controlled to a point where they don't have any freedom, and then one day they just think, I'm never going to get away from this person. They're literally going to control my life forever. I am going to have to kill them. And they do. And while some have gone to prison, others have walked free because the battered woman syndrome is now considered an actual defense for the right reasons. It doesn't make sense to a lot of us. Why didn't you just leave? But if you haven't been in that situation where you've ever felt that you could truly escape this person without essentially being murdered yourself, you won't be able to connect with it. And I'm just throwing that in as an example as to why certain people will act in a way that just seems so extreme when the rest of us are looking and thinking, well, there were like a million other options, like go to the police and tell them the truth about your father, speak to a member of a family who can maybe help you move forward. However, if they genuinely believed their parents were going to kill them, would never let them escape, and that the father had the resources to be able to do that, maybe killing them in their heads was the only way they could manage the situation. Doesn't make sense, like I said, and it's certainly not something I defend, but I'm just picking out the understandable features that we see in certain actions of people on a psychological level who do get engaged in these kind of crimes. Now, when it came down to the defense closing argument where Abramson was concerned, one of the things that they did was accuse the prosecution witnesses of being liars, saying you're all publicity seekers, again, attacked Ozeal's credibility again. Interestingly, she said, I don't want Eric to be taking the rap for Lyle. The evidence in this case does not prove that Eric killed anybody. So kind of drawing that destabilizing of opinion that they were both equally culpable and saying, look, yes, these people died, but I don't believe that Eric killed anybody. Kuriyama, obviously, prosecution, really, really does not like the brothers. His closing argument literally took just 3 hours. And the reason for that is he was like, I don't need any more time. At the end of the day, this is easy for you to understand as a jury. He said, I'm not going to dazzle you. I'm going to ask you to base your decision in this case on common sense. He told the jury Eric was gay and said, if the defendant were engaging in consensual sex with other men, that would account for him being able to describe what he described for you, his sexual encounters with his father. Again, that guy is lucky I wasn't in the actual room at the point of him saying that, because I would have thrown something at his head as well. How ludicrous. How absolutely ludicrous. You have to actually have engaged in homosexual acts to know what it's like to be anally sodomized. I nearly swore then, and it began with F and there was an O next to it. But it is just so utterly disrespectful that literally lawyers are saying this bullshit. He said that Jose did not force Eric into sex acts, but no, Jose was just furious that Eric was gay. So Jose is just this stand-up guy who's just dealing with the issue with his son not turning out to be the straight kid that he wants. He's really angry about the fact that his son is going out and having sexual experiences with other men, and therefore Eric has decided that he's going to punish his father by murdering him and making up that maybe he was actually that way inclined himself to some degree because Jose was apparently molesting him. It's crazy that that was actually used in closing arguments, but it was. Now, at this point, the jury were given four choices. Guilty of first-degree murder with special circumstances, guilty of second-degree murder, guilty of voluntary manslaughter, guilty of involuntary manslaughter. So Lyle and Eric basically faced sentencing on three counts: the murder of Jose, the murder of Kitty, and also conspiracy to commit murder. We get to the 13th of January, 1994. This is after 16 days of deliberation. Eric's jury announced it was deadlocked and it was unable to reach an agreement on any of the counts after all that. 25th of January, 1994. This is after 24 days of deliberation, because bear in mind there were two separate juries for each of the men, even though they were tried at the same time. Lyle's jury announced it was deadlocked. So in both juries, there was this common theme. So the male jurors wanted to convict them of first-degree murder. The female jurors wanted to convict them of manslaughter. They felt sorry for them after the accounts of abuse. And that, again, is interesting to me, because I do not believe for 1 minute that women are easy to convince on a jury. We might be more emotionally based. So what we know psychologically is that women are more invested in relationships than things. Men often have a great connection with things and love relationships, but not quite at the same level as women. So we have separateness in who we are as genders, whether people want to argue with that or otherwise. That's what the research evidence is. And one of the things that women tend to be is more empathetic and more agreeable. So we might look at things in a more emotional way, but also it means that when it comes down to a case like this, which many people could look at cold and say they deserve to burn in hell, and instead take the nuances. And so the nuances are clearly playing out. They're believing that these young men have been abused. And like I said, women can be hugely judgmental. Hugely judgmental when it comes down to people taking the lives of others. And you bet your bottom dollar, if those boys were not convincing, those young men were not convincing on the stand, they would not be doing that, but be sniffing it out. But the men, they are quite centered on the idea that no, they've absolutely lied about this. They deserve to go to prison for the rest of their natural lives and be put to death. So there's this deadlock. It's important to note that only one of the 24 jurors had actually voted for the least serious charge, though, of involuntary manslaughter. So only one of them was like, listen, these guys need to get the lowest of the offence. Now, in Eric's jury, specifically female jurors complained that one of the things they struggled with was sexist bullying and male jurors' really homophobic suspicions about Eric's sexuality. And they said that, as far as they're concerned, one of the reasons that there hadn't been a resolution of the case. So these guys were like, oh, he deserves it because he's gay. And again, think about the time. We are in a much more enlightened zone these days, thank God. But back then, let's just say, homophobia was really prevalent, and even the person for the prosecution using the closing arguments clearly was somebody who was homophobic. So the women are saying, look, we felt bullied and intimidated, and that's why there wasn't a resolution. Now, after 3 months, can you believe that? 3 months of deliberations, the jury is still deadlocked. Now, the judge at this point declares a mistrial, which is just like exhausting, isn't it? So all of that has happened. All of those things have been gone through. All of those witnesses have come and given evidence, and now it's a mistrial. So Los Angeles County District Attorney Gil Garcetti immediately announced that the brothers, of course, would be retried. So it wasn't like they're going to walk. It was just, okay, let's do it again. Now, just to bring you a bit of context, O.J. Simpson. I'm sure most of you know who O.J. Simpson is. If not, just have a Google. Like I said, there's this weird connection with the Menendez brothers and the advert and the father and O.J. Simpson. What happened in between the end of the Menendez first trial and the beginning of their second, O.J. Simpson's trial is publicized. Now, at this point, I would say the media went crazy and basically the Menendez brothers became old news. The public's attention was fully on O.J.'s utterly scandalous trial. Coincidentally, O.J. Simpson had visited the Menendez family in the days when he was appearing in adverts for Hertz. Jose had invited him to dinner so that Lyle and Eric could meet him because he was a big deal, you know? He was incredibly well respected. Now, OJ and the Menendez brothers didn't actually meet again until they were all in the celebrity section of the Los Angeles County Jail. And of course, all three of them had been charged with double murder because he, OJ, had killed his then ex-partner and her friend. And these boys were accused of murdering their parents. But a very strange coincidence. Now, Judge Stanley Weisberg also was a judge in the OJ case. Also, it was held in the same building as the Menendez brothers' trial. Now, after OJ was, I would say, sensationally and wrongly found not guilty, and it was a verdict, believe me, that I was not alone in imagining was going to play out because it just seemed so obvious that he was guilty, people really struggled because it came down to the defense of, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. Now, like I said, one, that's BS. I might just have a glove that doesn't fit perfectly, but I can still use it to kill somebody with by covering a part of my hand with it when I'm knifing them to death. But that was kind of the headline. If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. Because of this, and because a lot of people were talking about it being just an absolute miscarriage, and rightfully so, of justice, Judge Weisberg was under a lot of pressure. Bear in mind, I wish it were so, guys, that the courts were all about justice. But I will tell you, more and more, I realise that the courts are about politics just as much as they are about justice. Sometimes they're more about politics than anything else. And it's exactly the same in America as it is in the UK. And it's shameful. It's absolutely shameful. Now, the Menendez trial, they'd had a deadlock jury. And of course, OJ had been found not guilty, which again, it's insanity that that were the case. Now, there was a lot of pressure on Weisberg from the DA's office to get a conviction. They were like, we don't need anybody else coming under the microscope and it being seen that we are an easy touch. You know, people want people to go to prison. People want them to be put to death. That was kind of the way they were approaching this. So Weisberg rules for a second trial. On the 3rd of April, 1995, they said the brothers are going to be retried together, this time in front of one single jury. Basically said that the advantage of a single trial outweighed the potential prejudice. This time he banned television cameras from the courtroom, also restricted testimony only to events relevant to Lyle and Eric's state of mind the week before the killings, which is ludicrous. Genuinely, you don't need any experience to know that that is wrong. You cannot look at a human being in just the week before their actions and say that defines who they are. And that gives us the correct ideas of what is going on in their minds. There is a whole interplay of history, but that's what they did. And that eliminates this potential parade of defense witnesses who'd obviously been called in the first trial to bolster the brothers' allegations that Jose was an abusive tyrant, which everybody says he was, essentially. Now, on top of that, the most damaging blow to the defense was that Weisberg's ruling that the principle of imperfect self-defense, which had previously been argued so effectively, was now inexplicable. So essentially, the goalposts have completely changed. So what this judge did was cite this footnote in a Supreme Court decision that had been rendered in another case after the first trial. The judge had determined that the principle could not be applied to the retrial because the defense had failed to provide sufficient evidence that Kitty Menendez had treated her sons in any way that might have provoked them to kill her. Really? I'm pretty sure that they told you in their defense that she was sexually abusing at least one of them whilst parading around naked, suggesting that they tell her how good she looked. I mean, with respect, she ripped the hair off the head of her son and humiliated him when she removed that toupee. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me that this woman, who apparently a family member, went and told her about the abuse that an 8-year-old son of hers was suffering? She denied it was occurring and told them to basically shut up. But apparently the judge says, no, there was no reason to kill her. Look, of course, it goes without saying there's never a reason, even though we may in our heart feel at times that there should be, to go ahead and kill people when they are committing these kind of atrocities. We should be able to introduce at least a level of defense about action regarding it. But this judge was having none of it. This judge was going through and trying to find out as much as possible to make this case destabilized so that they were found guilty. And that's not okay. Listen, find them guilty, fine. Do it fairly. But that's not how this next trial plays out. The Menendez brothers would be convicted of first-degree murder, according to this judge, or nothing at all. So all those other options that were on the table before, gone. Now, for the retrial, there were new lawyers. David Conn, he was a veteran Los Angeles County Assistant DA, and ADA Carol Najera. They replaced Pam Bosnick and Lester Kuriyama. Now, Conn had 18 years of experience and was actually acting head deputy of the major crime unit of the Los Angeles County DA's office. And Conn actually spent 2.5 years mapping out the strategy that he would basically use to dismantle the defense. That's a long time, and this person is a seasoned individual in this manner. So they were going for the jugular. It was as simple as that. And let's be honest, the judge had made it easier for that jugular to absolutely be slashed.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.